Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord, trust in him, and he will do this. He will make your righteousness shine like the dawn, like justice, the justice of your cause like the noonday sun. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when men succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret, it leads only to evil. For evil men will be cut off, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. A little while and the wicked will be no more. Though you look for them, they will not be found. But the meek will inherit the land and enjoy great peace. Psalm 37 is a psalm of perspective. I've got a slide that's got the word perspective on, if Gary can put that on for us, yeah? The ordinary word and then with a little bit of perspective in it. And David gives us many warnings, many encouragements that help us to keep our eyes fixed on God and help us to live life with a sense of God being at the centre. Now, perspective obviously has two main meanings. If we're talking about it in art terms, it's the art of representing three-dimensional objects on a two-dimensional surface. Yeah, so as to give you an impression of their height and their width and depth and their position in relation to each other. And there are many artists whose paintings and drawings are incredibly realistic. Yeah, they portray the world as we see it so accurately that their work and drawings, you know, they almost look like a photograph. So you've got landscape artists such as Turner or Constable. These pictures, you know, famous paintings. You know, those paintings look as real as the actual scenes that they're depicting. Portrait artists who've got that kind of skill, they can draw and paint people who really look like people. Not like me when I draw somebody, you know, and it just looks like a stick, if I'm lucky. Now, there are other artists, of course, who deliberately distort perspective to create a reality that perhaps seems a bit weird to us. We've got artists like Picasso or Mondrian or Van Gogh. Yeah, their paintings, their artwork doesn't really look like we see things. And they want us to see beyond the visible reality all around us and find something different within their works. And whether we like a particular artist or not, or whether, you know, we think that's a bit weird or a bit disturbing and we reject their perspective, that really just depends on our personal preferences and on our own perspectives. But the word perspective obviously has another meaning, a particular attitude towards something or a way of regarding something, a point of view. So we can talk about your outlook, you know, your viewpoint, your stance, your attitude, your frame of mind. And both of those meanings are connected to the idea of the visual. Perspective comes from a Latin word, you know, which means the science of optics, how you see things. So it's all about seeing what we see and how we interpret what we see. Now, when I was a child, I was just as short-sighted as I am as an adult. But for a little while, I didn't actually know that. I'd got no framework or reference to judge visual ability. So I saw the world through blurry vision. But I didn't know it was blurry, because that was the only world that I'd ever known. And my short-sightedness only really came to light when I went to school and I had to copy things down off the blackboard. But I couldn't see properly to do that, so I'd copy from the person sitting next to me, and the teacher obviously thought, what's going on here, you know, and worked out eventually that obviously I wasn't copying because I was trying to copy work, I was copying because I couldn't see the blackboard. And I was referred to an optician. And, you know, a lot of people say that children don't like wearing glasses because, you know, they get picked on, they get called names and things like that. They get teased, you know, about it. But I was so short-sighted that when I went to the optician and actually got some lenses where I could see and the world suddenly became so clear to me, it was like, wow, this is fantastic. I don't care if I have to wear glasses and people call me names because now I can actually see what everybody else is, you know, seeing. So the day that I got my first pair of glasses, it was like seeing the world in colour for the first time. Everything was sharp and defined and clear. And I could see the details that previously just had been obscure. Like, I could see the blackboard. I could see what was on television. I could read number plates at a distance. You know, everything else, you know, all those things that, you know, if you've got good eyesight, you just take those things for granted. You know, at the opticians, when they kind of show you these things, you know, which black line is more clear and things like that, it actually made a difference. You know, they were putting the lenses into those frames and suddenly I could see. If you've got normal vision, then in some ways, you know, you just take that for granted. When you don't have normal vision, you realise that what you see is more subjective than perhaps other people realise. And what's true for us physically is also true for us spiritually. We've got a spiritual vision and perspective which we might think is normal. Yeah? Because it's all we've ever known. It's the only spiritual vision that we've ever known. But as we grow up and we meet other people and we discover that not everybody thinks the same way that we do, you know, we realise that perhaps we've got to change our perspective. Maybe we've got the right attitudes to some things, but the wrong ones to others. And so we've got to learn to sift and evaluate our perspective. You know, our perspective can change as we grow up, as we get older, as we learn more things, as we meet more people. And if we're going to grow spiritually, we discover that the perspective of the world doesn't sit very happily in parallel with God's perspective. It's actually in complete opposite to it. And we've got the challenge daily of allowing our vision to be brought in line with God's. Just as the correcting lenses at an optician's are adjusted slightly, you know, so that we see even more clearly, our vision's got to be adjusted so that it lines up with God's vision and God's perspective rather than our own. And Psalm 37 is to me a bit like an optician's lens, because it acts as a way for God to sharpen our vision, to define our perspective, and to get us back on the right track. It's another one of those lenses that God's provided us. Eugene Peterson says that the artist has eyes to connect the visible and the invisible, and the skill to show us complete what we in our inattentive distraction can only see in bits and pieces. These artists that we admire, whether it's, you know, paintings or photographs, or whether it's writers or musicians, what they do is actually show us something that's there, but they help us to get into focus a little bit better. Many of the prophecies in the Bible are very visual. Yeah, they're describing what the prophets saw. Because the great masters of the imagination don't make things up out of thin air. They direct our attention to what's right before our eyes, but then they train us to see it whole. Not as fragments, but in context with all the connections. I don't know if you've ever, you know, listened to a piece of music or read something, and it's almost like there's an unveiling, isn't it? You actually knew what that person's communicating, but you didn't realise that you knew it. You didn't understand it. We see it from a different perspective, and then things look entirely different. And in Psalm 37, David's writing to people who are looking at life through the wrong set of lenses. You know, because anybody that views life from a purely temporal point of view is as short-sighted as I am when I take my glasses off. Yeah? There's so much more to life than what our eyes can actually see. And much of the psalm looks at the realities of life summed up in black and white terms as good and evil. Because David starts off writing about evil men. You know, he says, those who are evil, those who are doing wrong. And he talks about what those people do, wicked schemes in verse 7. He says in verse 12, we didn't get as far as that, but he says the wicked plot against the righteous. He says that they draw the sword and they bend the bow to bring down the poor and needy, to slay those whose ways are upright. In verse 21, he says those kind of people borrow and do not repay. In verse 32, they lie in wait for the righteous, intent on putting them to death. And you know, David knows full well what wicked people look like. He says in verse 35, he's seen a wicked and ruthless man flourishing like a luxuriant native tree. He knows that life for those who love God can seem a lot more difficult than for those who have no thought of God whatsoever. And the reason for that, of course, is that the world's hostile to God. It's under the control of the ruler of the air. Satan is called the prince of this world. And he's totally and utterly opposed to God and to God's people. We looked at that in the Bible study. When we were looking at him being the accuser of the brethren. All of us, before we came to know Christ, followed his ways. And we were dead in our transgression and sin, Paul says. We didn't realise it, but that's the truth. And there are only two camps in this world. You know, there's God's and there's Satan's. And it matters very much which one we belong to, because you can't be neutral in spiritual things. Jesus said, whoever's not with me is against me, and whoever does not gather with me scatters. So the first thing that the psalm teaches us is that wickedness and evil are real, and we're at best misguided and naive if we think otherwise. David's not pretending that there are no evil people around. And he never says that there won't be opposition and there won't be trouble. You know, Jesus himself told his disciples, didn't he? If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. Yeah, he said bluntly, you know, in this world you will have trouble. And anyone who preaches, you know, otherwise, glossing over the difficulties or denying that suffering and opposition and persecution will come, they're not preaching the same gospel that Jesus did. We've been looking at that as we've been studying 1 John. 1 John 3 verse 18 says, do not be surprised, my brothers and sisters, if the world hates you. And the fact that suffering, opposition and persecution will be part of life while ever we're on this earth is repeated frequently in the Bible. Peter says, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal that's come on you to test you as though something strange were happening. Paul tells Timothy point blank, everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. And most of us perhaps have, you know, we've accepted those facts, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we've got a biblical perspective on the matter. Because the other view that's very common is that evil exists, yes, but then the consequence of that is that we become afraid, or we become resentful, or confused, or anxious. And David's not writing just simple facts about the wicked and the schemes they're involved in. He's giving us instructions about how we should react to the evil all around us and what our perspective and what our attitudes need to be. Because he opens this psalm saying, do not fret because of those who are evil or be envious of those who do wrong. And in verse 7 and 8 he says, do not fret when people succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret, it leads only to evil. He reminds us what we should do and what we shouldn't do. We should turn from evil and do good, he says in verse 27. And it's clear that one of the wrong perspectives that we can have regarding evil is that it's all powerful and that it will go unpunished. That's the view that many people have. And they're stumbling blocks for people. How can a good God allow evil to continue? Why is it that righteous living doesn't seem to bring us any benefits? How can it be that people who are evil seem to flourish? You know, like this luxuriant tree. People who are good seem to suffer so much. You know, in the words of a best-selling book, why do bad things happen to good people? And vice versa. Why do good things happen to bad people? Why do so many of us feel, perhaps, you know, like a mangy child, it's not fair, God? And those questions are not avoided in the Bible. You know, they're not ignored. Many of the Psalms address them honestly and bluntly. Perhaps the most famous of those, Psalm 73, when Asaph talks about his feet nearly slipping because he envied the arrogant and the prosperity of the wicked, saying of these people, they have no struggles, their bodies are healthy and strong, they are free from common human burdens, they're not plagued by human ills. You know, he says, this is what the wicked are like, always free of care, they go on amassing wealth. And, you know, there are lots of examples of people wrestling with those questions in the Bible. Habakkuk says, why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrongdoing? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife, conflict abounds. Therefore the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. We've got the sons of Korah. In Psalm 44, you know, that psalm talks about being rejected and abandoned by God. They, you know, they're saying, we've not done anything wrong, God, and you've just walked out on us. People face these questions honestly. But David's answer to those disturbing questions is that it's all a question of our perspective. The reaction, you know, that he wants us to have is not to fret. And the reason that he urges us not to fret and not to be envious of the wicked is because in the end of verse 2 it says, they're like the grass, they will soon wither. Like green plants, they will soon die away. In verse 9 he says that those who are evil will be destroyed, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. In verse 10 he says, a little while and the wicked will be no more. Though you look for them, they will not be found. You know, he takes this long-term view without which our hearts will fail us and our feet will slip. And so did Asaph at the end, yeah? At the end of Psalm 73, he said, when I tried to understand all this, it troubled me deeply till I entered the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their final destiny. Surely you place them on slippery ground. You cast them down to ruin. How suddenly are they destroyed, completely swept away by terrors. So we can't flourish spiritually if we've got this short-term perspective on life. David says, the wicked will perish. Though the Lord's enemies are like the flowers of the field, they will be consumed. They will go up in smoke. In verse 28, he says, wrongdoers will be completely destroyed. The offspring of the wicked will perish. In verse 33, he says that even if the wicked plot against God's people, the Lord will not leave them in the power of the wicked or let them be condemned when brought to trial. He's honest about the evil that he's seen, but he's also confident in God's ability to deal with evil. He declares in verses 35 and 36, I've seen a wicked and ruthless man flourishing like a luxuriant native tree, but he soon passed away and was no more. Though I looked for him, he could not be found. He reminds God's people in verse 38, all sinners will be destroyed. There will be no future for the wicked. And a long-term perspective is desperately needed if we're going to see clearly. It's the only way that we can make sense of the baffling aspects of life and can hold on in times of trial and trouble. Paul knew this because he wrote to the Corinthians, we're hard pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. And he went on to say that we know that the one who raised the Lord Jesus from the dead will also raise us with Jesus and present us with you to himself. In 2 Corinthians 4, where those verses come from, he says at the end of that chapter, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we're being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles, and they don't seem very light or very momentary at times to us, are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen, since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Phil Wickham sings a song called When My Heart Is Torn Asunder. And in that he says, when my heart is torn asunder and my world just falls apart, Lord, you put me back together and lift me up to where you are. There is hope beyond the suffering, joy beyond the tears, peace in every tragedy, love that conquers fear. I have found redemption in the blood of Christ. My body might be dying, but I'll always be alive. You have turned mourning to dancing. You have covered me with grace. The struggle here may last a moment, but life with you will last always. And without that long-term view and security in both God's ability to do something about evil and his intrinsic goodness, we just flounder. We view life wrongly. And many of us have faulty vision at both those hurdles. You know, we can see the evil all around us and we quake before it. Or we fail to see any evil at all and we just assume that the world's quite benign and pleasant. And the devil doesn't mind which of those views we take because both of them are wrong. We're either blithe and ignorant of his schemes or we're paranoid and fearful. But either way, those are accurate perspectives. We need to wake up to the evil in the world, but we also need to know that evil's not inexhaustible. It's not infinite. It's not worth a lifetime of attention. We need to have a right view of evil. Yes, it's prevalent. Yes, it's anti-God, but it's restricted by God. You know, Jesus told Pilate, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. When we're, you know, when we've got that right perspective on evil, we're freed from anxiety and fear, and we're confident in God's ability and power. He's in control. David says, verse 18, the blameless spend their days under the Lord's care, and their inheritance will endure forever. The blameless spend their days under the Lord's care, and their inheritance will endure forever. So, we need to be convinced of God's goodness, the fact that he doesn't delight in evil, he rejoices with the truth. We've got a loving God, yeah? And we haven't got this loving God who's powerless. We haven't got a powerful God who's callous, because people have those views, don't they? You know, if God's good, well, the reason that evil exists must be because he can't really do anything about it. If God's all-powerful, then he's just cruel and awful for letting things carry on. You know, we need to have the right vision of God, the right perspective. You know, if we've got either of those views, we're, you know, it's like being long-sighted or short-sighted. You know, David is not only at pains to show us how wrong we can be when we take the short-term perspective, he's careful to show us that there are many, many benefits, both now and in the future, of our discipleship. Because he says in verses 3 to 4, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land, enjoy safe pasture. Take delight in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. He says that if we commit our ways to God and trust in him, he will make your righteous reward shine like the dawn, your vindication like the noonday sun. Carrying on in verse 9, he says, those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. In verse 11, the meek will inherit the land and enjoy peace and prosperity. Verse 18, the blameless spend their days under the Lord's care, and their inheritance will endure forever. He says that the Lord makes firm the steps of the one who delights in him. Though he may stumble, he will not fall, for the Lord upholds him with his hand. And so there's a lot of positive truth in there as well. Yeah? Tells us that the Lord loves the just, will not forsake his faithful ones. In verse 29, he says, the righteous will inherit the land and dwell in it forever. You know, he says, the salvation of the righteous comes from the Lord. He is their stronghold in times of trouble. The Lord helps them and delivers them. He delivers them from the wicked and saves them because they take refuge in him. And perhaps one of the most amazing things he says is in verse 25. I was young, now I'm old, yet I've never seen the righteous forsaken or their children begging bread. You know, he's not just saying this from theory now, is he? He's saying, you know, I've never seen. He's talking from a lifetime of experience of trusting God. We see that again in verses 35 and 36. He says, I have seen a wicked and ruthless man flourishing like this luxuriant native tree, but he soon passed away and was no more. Though I looked for him, he could not be found. And there's a powerful witness when we combine the truth of God's word with our own personal experience. When we can proclaim truth and say, I have seen this, or I've not seen that ever. Yeah, David was a man, he'd got many enemies. You know, we know the backstory to a lot of the incidents that he writes about in the Psalms. So for him to be able to testify that God dealt with his enemies isn't just hearsay. It's practical truth for him. You know, he can say that he's experienced God's provision, God's care for his children. And that's an encouragement to other people who perhaps might not feel as confident about God's ability to do that. And that's one of the many ways that we can build each other up and encourage each other in faith. We remind each other of God's faithfulness to us, you know, and we can encourage people. As Hebrews 10 tells us, we've got this duty to spur each other on to good deeds by dwelling on God's faithfulness and by encouraging each other. One of my favourite quotations comes perhaps surprisingly from a German philosopher, Nietzsche. Okay. Now, I say surprisingly because I'd agree with virtually nothing of what Nietzsche said. Nietzsche was an atheist. He was even way more pessimistic than I am, and that's saying something. But the quotation I like says this. We've got it on the screen. The essential thing in heaven and earth is that there should be a long obedience in the same direction. There thereby results, and has always resulted in the long run, something which has made life worth living. A long obedience in the same direction. If we are to live with clear-sighted, God-centered vision, we've got to be prepared to live with that long obedience in the same direction. We can't be hypocrites saying one thing and doing another. And we've got to interpret the now not only in the light of the past, what God has done, what God said, how God's worked in our own lives. You know, I've seen God do this or I've never seen God do that. But we've got to interpret it in the light of the future, what God's going to do. And a lot of this psalm talks about what God will do. Yeah, it says, verse 4, take delight in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Verse 6, he will make your righteous reward shine like the dawn. Verse 9, those who are evil will be destroyed, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. If you want to look through the psalm, you'll see that there's lots of these future tenses. You know, though he may stumble, he will not fall. Wrongdoers will be completely destroyed. The offspring of the wicked will perish. The righteous will inherit the land. And David's confidence looks ahead to the future. And there's a sense in which this always has to be the case with us too. You know, in that great resurrection chapter in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, if only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied. Any stance which focuses exclusively on the now, never learning from the past, never remembering, and never looking ahead in anticipation to the future, will always lack something. Now-oriented religion, a security-obsessed present which lives entirely in the now, will never satisfy us. Because we were made for more than this. Yeah? We were made for more than ordinary lives. We're made for more than the present. God set eternity in the human heart. So we can't simply be content with the material, with the temporal, with things that are impermanent. There's got to be the sense that we're always looking ahead. And that's not just imagining the future is going to be, you know, better than now, a better version of what we see, you know, greener trees or bluer seas or things like that. You know, it's accepting that these things that God will do, they're shaping us for something far better, far greater than we can possibly imagine. Paul says, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no human mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. Now that's a quote from Isaiah, Isaiah 64 verse 4. And in Isaiah it says, since ancient times no one has heard, no ear has perceived, no eye has seen any God besides you, who acts on behalf of those who wait for him. And that reminds us, doesn't it, that we've got something to do now, in the present. We've got to wait for God. And David says this in verse 7 of this psalm, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. One of the chief tactics that we've got for renewing our perspective, ensuring that we've got the right lenses in front of our eyes, is waiting for God, hoping in him, being still, giving up our frenetic activity, learning to be like Mary, you know, sitting at the feet of Jesus, listening to what he says, rather than being like Martha, distracted by activities. Those are like the filters that we've got to put on our eyes. A bit like horses when they've got the blinkers. Yeah? In races, sometimes you see the horses have blinkers so that they're concentrating on racing. And we've got to come before God daily, learning to wait, to hope, to listen, so that we're avoiding distractions and we're maintaining our focus. We've got to be convinced of the good things that God has in store for us, the blessings that are still to come, the justice that will not be forgotten, the restoration that's not yet been made visible. And we've got to have that long-term vision that John uncovers for us in the book of Revelation. You know, at the end of Revelation, you'll be very familiar. God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. I don't know if you've ever read C.S. Lewis's book, The Last Battle. It's the last book in the Chronicles of Narnia, the Christian allegory, lots of spiritual truth in it. And right at the end of the book, which has had several books talking all about, you know, God and what he's going to be doing, it says, the term is over, the holidays have begun, the dream is ended, this is the morning. And as he spoke, he no longer looked to them like a lion. But the things that began to happen after that were so great and beautiful that I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of all stories, and we can most truly say they all lived happily ever after. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world, and all their adventures in Narnia, had only been the cover and the title page. Now at last they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before. And David knows something of that future hope. He's seeking to remind people that there's so much more to be revealed, so much more to be experienced and known of God than all we currently see, all we currently know, all we currently experience. You know, we might have wrong perspectives now, but if we take the truths from this psalm, we find we see things just that little bit more clearly in the here and now, and we can look ahead with confidence. God's our stronghold, he says in verse 39, our refuge, the one who delivers us, the one who holds us up, and the one whose plans for us are to give us hope and a future. He says in verse 37, a future awaits those who seek peace. So it's time that we take our glasses off, polish up those lenses, so that we can see more clearly.